This is the State of Things broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stacio. Trita Parsi was born in pre-revolution Iran in the early 1970s. His family left the country when he was just 4 years old, but his connection to Iranian people, culture, and politics has remained strong throughout his life. Early in his career, he worked for the United Nations, addressing human rights issues in Iran, Afghanistan, Myanmar, and Iraq. After the attacks on September 11th, he founded the National Iranian American Council to organize and strengthen the voice of Iranian Americans and to bridge the gap between American and Iranian people. He has since authored two books on U.S.-Iran relations and advises Western and Asian governments on foreign policy. He's in town for a talk about the Iran nuclear deal at UNC Chapel Hill and Duke, but first joins me in the studio, Trita Parsi. Welcome to the State. Thanks. Good to have you.
Thank you so much for having me.
Tell us about your earliest years. Born in Iran in the early 70s. Remind us what was happening in that country then.
Well, I was very small, so I can't say that I necessarily remember it myself, but in the late 1970s, there was a lot of upheaval and commotion in Iran, protests against the Shah's regime, which eventually led to the Iranian Revolution in 1979, in February of that year, when it was completed. And with that also a very dark chapter, both for Iran itself, because of the internal developments, because of the invasion by Saddam Hussein of Iran, as well as the very poor relations that emerged between the United States and Iran following the hostage crisis.
Your father was an outspoken academic who was imprisoned twice. He was no friend of the Shah or the Ayatollah Khomeini.
Yeah, it's a pretty interesting story. My father was jailed the first time in the late 1970s for having said something critical of the Shah during one of his lectures. He was a professor at the university. And then later on, when he came out, the family decided to leave for Sweden. Things were very unstable at the time, and we went to Sweden. And once we arrived, a couple of months later, the revolution is completed, and my father's name is put in the paper as one of the individuals that the new government, the Khomeini government, the Khomeini regime, said would be executed on the spot if he returned to Iran, accusing him of having been a collaborator with the Shah's secret service, which A, was not true, B, my father was actually tortured by the Savak. But my father goes back to Iran to clear his name. And that was important in his view because at the time, the revolutionary government was no different from the Taliban in the sense that if they couldn't get a hold of you, they may just execute a relative. So my father went back to clear his name and ironically ended up in the same jail that he was in just a year or so earlier during the time of the Shah, ending up sharing a jail cell with the guy who was the head of that jail just a year earlier. So his former prison ward was now his prison mate. The revolutionary government did end up executing that individual, but my father managed to clear his name for a very simple reason. Guess who's running the jail in a revolutionary country? 20-year-old former students at the university. Some of them, my father's former students, who knew of my father and his views. And as a result, after 34 days in that jail, he managed to clear his name, left the country, and he's not been back since.
The family was still in Sweden. I assume he returned to the family. What was it like? Were you able to maintain contact? And what was it like for your family that suddenly found itself uprooted?
Well, at that time, there were a lot of Iranians that left Iran because of the revolution. And then, of course, afterwards, because of the invasion by Saddam Hussein of Iran and that started the Iraq-Iran war. And one thing that is important to understand when it comes to people who flee war or who flee those type of circumstances in their home, ancestral home, is that they don't leave with a plan of staying somewhere else. They're not economic refugees that are looking for a better life, a completely new life in a different country. They're there because they think whatever is happening in their ancestral home is temporary, and they'll just have to be outside for a year or two, and then they'll go back. So essentially, they're in a mentality in which they essentially live in a suitcase, constantly ready to go back, which means that so much of your continuous life was about your ancestral home, and in my case, Iran, because we weren't there to settle. We were not there to stay. And almost without exception, of course, there's some exceptions. People ended up staying. That's why you have big diasporas of Iranians in Europe, as well as in the United States. I think in total about 4 million Iranians living outside of Iran. That's 4 million out of a country of 80 million.
Well, what is it that, I mean, again, you can imagine, as you say, the supreme effort that a family would make to maintain its understanding of its culture in whatever context. But given the turmoil, I mean, you talked about those students who we now learn were in some ways manipulated by the Ayatollah. We thought it was over and against, but in fact it was a bulwark against a moderate, the moderates who were gaining some political traction in the aftermath of the revolution. This outflanked them. So the role of students, of the clergy, and of a robust middle class, which had been seriously underreported in this country, the fact that the Iranian had a well-educated middle class that we weren't told about through the media. What culture do you talk about? What's the story that gets told at home?
I think to a very large extent, it's very difficult to just be able to focus on the culture because everything was so politicized at the time. Much of the culture, of course, was politicized as well. But I think one of the fascinating things, particularly when it comes to the Iranian diaspora and what is now the Iranian-American community, is that Iranians have actually not left mainland Iran in large numbers at all up until 1979. They have no experience being in a minority in a different country. They have no experience of being a diaspora. You compare that to other Middle Eastern communities, obviously the Jewish community, who is the world champions of living outside of historic Palestine or Israel, or Armenians, etc. That meant that once they were outside, they didn't have the skill sets to be able to maintain culture or be organized as a community. So it's been a very sharp learning curve for the Iranian-American community and the Iranian communities in Europe, etc. It's a very different experience.
Tell us about then, you worked for the UN for a time, the General Assembly's Third Committee addressing human rights issues. What was your interest in that? When did you become interested? And tell us about that position.
Well, I was actually working for the Swedish government. So I was a member of the Swedish delegation to the UN. I was working in the Security Council and at the Third Committee of the General Assembly that deals with these issues. The interest in this has been with me since I was a very small kid, precisely because of what we were experiencing. I noticed that very clearly my children have very little interest in politics, and I'm not unhappy about that necessarily, but they've not been exposed to it. They've not had any type of a trauma in their life in the same way that me and my older brother did. I mean, we said goodbye to my father for the last time when he left. We had hopes that he would come back, but not necessarily expectations. And I remember that very, very vividly. I was only four. And my brother is working in the same field in Europe right now. So I think this formed our childhood so intensely. And I think perhaps also important to note that I'm from the southern part of Iran. And that was exactly where Saddam Hussein invaded. So my family and the families of everyone we knew from that area were very directly affected by everything that war brings, killings, families being torn apart, chemical weapons, all of those things were things that I essentially grew up with.
So what kind of work did you do? You have been critical of Iran's human rights record, as well as other countries. What was your area of focus? What were you doing in that job?
Well, I was actually a very low-level third secretary at the Swedish delegation at the time. So my job was primarily to help the more senior diplomats and learn. But it was an absolutely fantastic experience, of course. And I got to see a lot of things, particularly in the Security Council, that further deepened my interest in going into the direction of international relations.
You came to the U.S. and studied foreign policy, originally going to study Afghanistan and the Taliban, but something happened to change your mind.
Yes. When I was in the Security Council, I was on the team that covered both Iraq, Tajikistan, and Afghanistan. And this is right at the moment where the Taliban essentially succeed and they control, after they take Mazar-e-Sharif, about 95% of Afghanistan. And it was very clear Afghanistan was a deeply understudied country. I mean, a lot of people in the United States were completely taken by surprise, had no idea what the Taliban were or what Al-Qaeda were up until 9/11 attacks. So I was going to focus on that issue until 9/11 happened 2 weeks after I began my PhD. And overnight, it was quite fascinating to see everyone in Washington had turned into Afghan experts. And I felt, well, okay, this market has saturated. and I need to go and focus on the next likely conflict in the region. And I predicted that it would be Iran and Israel. So I began focusing on that issue, which was a very tough issue. And it was an issue in which a lot of people discouraged me from going, saying it's too risky. And certainly it was risky, but it was also extremely rewarding at the end of the day.
You make the point that there's a common, what you would call misperception, that the tensions in the Middle East, Arab-Israeli, Muslim-Israeli, and in particular Iranian relationship with Iran, are these ancient tensions that go way back. And, you know, 'twas ever thus, that leads to a kind of hopelessness about what can be done in the future. But you, your research and others suggest that's not true.
Well, the point I'm making is that there clearly are ancient conflicts in the region, but there's oftentimes a perception that the tensions between Iran and Israel is yet another one of those ancient Middle Eastern conflicts. And that is so not the case. In fact, Israel and Iran, for the first decades of Israel's existence, had a very strong relationship. And if you go further back in history, the relationship between the Iranian peoples and the Jewish people have been tremendously positive over the course of 2.5 millennia. The point I'm making, though, in the book, based on extensive interviews with both Iranian, American, and Israeli officials covering the entire span of 40 to 50 years, is to show that the root of the conflict between Iran and Israel and the driver of that conflict has been geostrategic calculations and tensions, not ideology. Certainly both sides utilize ideology as a legitimizer of their policies, as the way to frame their position and the conflict. But that does not mean that it is ideology that is actually driving it. And I think when I first came out with the book, after my dissertation was published, Treacherous Alliance, it was deemed a rather controversial idea. By now, I think it's been accepted as the factor. And I think particularly over the summer, we saw very clearly with Prime Minister Netanyahu's conduct as well, that this has far, far deeper roots than just believing that this is something that is driven by ideology.
And the book you're talking about is Treacherous Alliance, The Secret Dealings of Israel, Iran, and the U.S., and I'm talking with author Trita Parsi today on the state of things. Well, then you point out that Yitzhak Rabin calls Iran Israel's best friend, really at the height or at one of the peaks of anti-Semitic, anti-Israel, and anti-Zionist rhetoric coming out of Iran. He says Iran is our best friend. What did he mean by that? And maybe this illustrates some of the geopolitical strategy that...
You see, when Israel was founded, within a decade or so, Ben-Gurion puts into place a doctrine that the Israelis call the doctrine of the periphery. The idea that Israel's security is best achieved by creating alliances with the non-Arab states in the periphery of the Middle East in order to balance the Arab states in Israel's vicinity. And the most important periphery power was Iran. It's non-Arab and it was rich on energy. During the 1970s, Iran provided up to about 75% of Israel's energy needs. And that created a perception of a very strong geopolitical common interest between Israel and Iran. Particularly on the Israeli side, they tended to believe that this geopolitical reality would be extremely enduring, if not permanent. That wasn't necessarily the case on the Iranian side. But once there was a regime change in Iran and the Ayatollahs came to power and they started using the most negative and venomous rhetoric against Israel, Israel kept on trying to establish relations with the Iranians. And it kept many of its military ties to the Iranians. It sold arms to the Iranians. It tried to convince the Reagan administration to talk to Iran. In fact, they were the instigators of the Iran-Contra scandal. Why? Because of the belief that this ideological component of the Iranian government is secondary at best. The geopolitical imperatives of Iran continue to dictate a need for a stronger relationship with Israel. And it is in that context that Rabin says Iran is Israel's best friend. And we do not intend to change our position vis-a-vis Tehran.
Well, then you have the dismantling of the Soviet Empire and the Iran-Iraq War. All of that starts to change the calculus in the region.
That changes the calculus, and this is what's so important. The calculus changes because of a change in the configuration, the geopolitical configuration of the region. Because suddenly the Soviet Union falls apart. That was one of the common threats. Saddam Hussein's Iraq is defeated in the Second Persian Gulf War by the United States and a UN coalition. And suddenly you have a scenario in the region in which there no longer are any clear conventional Arab military threats to Israel. Instead, Iran emerges as one of the winners of the Second Persian Gulf War. And the perception is created in Israel that now there no longer is anything to buffer Israel against Israel, against Iran. And that if the United States would start to move closer to Tehran as Iran was starting to become more pragmatic, that that would actually come at the expense of Israel's strategic significance. And it's at that point that we see a sparking of the Israeli-Iranian enmity that happens as a result of these geopolitical reconfigurations, not because of ideology, because ideology at that time was cooling quite significantly in Iran. It was much, much more prominent a decade earlier at a moment when Israel actually was trying to reestablish relations with Iran.
But you make the point you have said that in that moment, in fact, Iran was more interested in peacemaking with Washington than to see Israel's destruction. Are those antithetical or is that really a sequence? I mean, does Iran make peace with Washington as a step in a project to destroy Israel? In other words, I have to have the U.S. at least neutral and better on my side or that project would fail.
No, I'll be frank and I'll say something that I think perhaps folks will be a little bit shocked by. I don't think Iran has had as an objective to destroy Israel ever. Certainly, they've been using extremely negative rhetoric against Israel. But this was primarily done in order to create a common denominator with the Arab streets because the Khomeini government wanted to be seen as a leader of the Islamic world. And it needed to bridge the Persian Arab divide, the Sunni Shia divide. And they used political Islam to do so. And they used anti-Israeli rhetoric in order to create a sense of commonality. I interviewed one of Khomeini's close advisors who explained to me that he had a 3-hour-long conversation with Khomeini about what Iran's position on Israel should be. And Khomeini's view was that the actual policy, not the stated policy, not the rhetorical policy, but the actual policy would be such that the Israeli-Palestinian issue was primarily a Palestinian issue that concerned the Palestinians. At the second level, it should concern the Arab states in Israel's vicinity. And only at the third rhetorical, ideological level should it concern Iran. And Iran should never position itself as a frontline state against Israel. It should never directly involve itself against Israel.
But this held
in the 1980s. It changes in the 1990s.
Well, I just want to ask you, though, if the rhetoric doesn't become policy. I mean, you think about Ronald Reagan. Let's take the other side of this. Ronald Reagan piously telling us all that he will never, ever negotiate with a terrorist while he's bringing cake to the Ayatollah Khomeini to exchange prisoners. He's lying to us. He's about to break the law. All of that, but the rhetoric itself, so the policy was not. He will absolutely negotiate with terrorists. He's lying to us because he has to pander politically owing to the image that they'd created for him. But that becomes the policy ultimately, doesn't it? I mean, it's more than just rhetoric. It becomes policy because people buy it and they elect a guy who's going to do just that.
Yeah, I don't know if I would draw such a parallel between how the United States uses rhetoric and how the Iranians use rhetoric. In some ways, the Iranians are trying to position themselves as some, perhaps a little bit similar to the Vatican. They have statements on what they would like to see, what they think is normative and should be done or should be achieved at some point or the way things should be. And then they have what they call operational policy, which is what they actually pursue. And there's a huge gap between the two. Things like they would like to see, global poverty should be eradicated. Now, is that Iran's responsibility? Not necessarily. But they still say that these things should be done or that they at some point need to be achieved, or that's the way things should be. And this is creating a tremendous problem. And this is part of the conundrum that is created when a state tries to portray itself as extremely ideological. And for the Iranians, and there's a lot of critique, of course, inside Iran itself against taking such a strong ideological rhetorical position, because it ends up dragging them into a whole set of different conflicts.
We'll talk about this more with Trita Parsi today on The State of Things as we look at the historic agreement, the nuclear agreement with Iran and the U.S. Trita Parsi, Treacherous Alliance is the name of his book. He's in town for a talk, and our conversation will continue on The State of Things in a moment. Stay tuned. This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stacio. The Iranian government announced yesterday that it has begun to deactivate uranium centrifuges to fulfill a landmark nuclear deal struck earlier this year. The deal came after months of negotiations, hearings, and closed-door meetings. And while policymakers continue to debate the impact of the deal, my guest today argues that one thing is certain. President Obama has proven that security is better achieved through diplomacy than confrontation. Trita Parsi is an author and foreign policy analyst, authored two books on the relationship between Iran and the U.S. He founded the National Iranian American Council, a nonprofit dedicated to strengthening the voice of Iranian Americans. He's in town for lectures at UNC Chapel Hill and Duke tonight and tomorrow. You can find out information about those talks at our website, stateofthings.org. So before the break, we were talking about U.S.-Iranian relations as well as Israel. We have this now historic agreement multinational agreement. Tell us about the impact of that and what significance you think this has. Is it a turning point in relations between the West, between the U.S. and Iran?
It certainly has the potential of being transformative. It's not just a transactional deal. This is not just something that achieves two amazingly important objectives. I mean, the brilliance of this deal is that even at its most minimalist definition, it avoids two disasters, the disaster of Iran getting a nuclear bomb and the disaster of a war with Iran. But I think he actually goes beyond that. He has the potential of being transformational. It can transform not just the relationship between the United States and Iran, but larger, the West and Iran. And it's also opened up the door for the potential of resolving other conflicts in the region through diplomacy. We would not have seen a conference this past weekend in Vienna on Syria that included both Saudi and Iran at the table for the first time, which is an absolute necessity in order to end the bloodshed in Syria, had it not been for the nuclear deal.
How did that bring
Because
that
prior to the nuclear deal, the policy of the United States was that it needed to isolate the nuclear deal and deal with that first before it could deal with any other issues. It did not want to see the Iranians be able to link the nuclear deal to other conflicts in the region or other issues and by that be able to gain leverage. Also, the United States was very worried that if it began negotiating with Iran on Syria, it would deeply upset Saudi Arabia, who was opposed to the idea of diplomacy with Iran, period, but mostly opposed that the United States would start talking about regional matters with Iran without Saudi being inside of the room. The United States did not have the leverage to be able to say no to Saudi Arabia out of a fear that if it upset it even further, it was upset enough that the Obama administration was pursuing diplomacy with Iran. But if it also started talking about regional matters, there was a risk, the administration calculated, that the Saudis would really move a lot of resources in order to sabotage the deal. So it respected that view of the Saudis. But now when the deal is struck, now the door opened up for this. And it's not a coincidence that only about 10 days after implementation date, when the Iranians started the work of pulling those centrifuges, etc., that we had this conference and both the Iranians and the Saudis were there. And there were explosive meetings there and some aspects of it probably not particularly good, but they also had some significant achievements in starting to establish certain principles of a frame for how to resolve the conflict in Syria.
You said one of the disasters that the agreement avoided or averted was the potential of Iran building a nuclear weapon, but critics would say, on the contrary, the deal itself will lead to precisely that. Let's listen to John McCain.
I worry that it's going to nuclearize the Middle East. I've already talked to some of the leaders in the Middle East. They are deeply concerned. They will be moved in the direction of acquiring nuclear weapons because they see this 5-year, 8-year, 10-year window that they're going to have to, as Iran acquires nuclear weapons after 10 years. But the other thing that's worrisome and really disturbing to me is when you give a promise to relieve the sanctions on Soleimani, the guy that sent in thousands of copper-tipped IEDs, General Dunford the other day said that the copper-tipped IEDs killed at least 500 Army and Marines, and they're lifting the sanctions against him? Someone's going to have to explain that to me.
Senator John McCain talking to NBC's Morning Joe, in fact, earlier this summer. So explain that to Senator McCain.
Well, on the last point that he raises, I think it's important to keep in mind something that the Israeli leader Moshe Dayan said. He said, "You make peace with your enemies, not with your friends." That's important to keep in mind, because if you want to pursue the logic that Senator McCain is pursuing, then we would never actually be able to resolve any of these issues. You are resolving this issue and actually relieving sanctions, etc., in order to make the negative behavior stop. If you don't, then you may feel very pure and you may feel that you haven't rewarded the other side, but the very problematic behavior that you're objecting to will continue. So if you're actually interested in getting it stopped, you have to do a give and take. And this was part of the give and take. On the issue that this actually would lead to the region nuclearizing, this is not a view that is strongly held by experts. It may be held by certain politicians, and they may have strong political motives for what they're saying. But bottom line is this. These other states in the region are also signatories of the Non-Proliferation Treaty. They would be violating the Non-Proliferation Treaty if they started building a nuclear weapon. If they go and adopt exactly what the Iranians have, which is a program that would be under the inspection of the Additional Protocol, we would all be much safer. So I actually, frankly, welcome them to go in that direction. Many of them have not adopted the Additional Protocol, a measure that the Iranians now have adopted as part of this deal. And if they had enrichment programs that were under the same type of scrutiny that Iran's nuclear program will be permanently, not just for 8 years, then that would actually make the world much, much safer. If Senator McCain is suggesting that actually, no, these states will go beyond that and they will go far beyond what the Iranians are doing and actually build a weapon and then kind of position the United States as a helpless spectator in that, that is a significant underestimation of American power. If Senator McCain believes that the United States is in a position of power that it can actually force Iran, a country that the United States has had no real relationship for the last 35 years, to capitulate, that it has that power, but it doesn't have the power to be able to tell the Saudis, a regime whose very security is provided by the United States, that it cannot violate the NPT treaty and build nuclear bombs, then I don't think he is fully appreciating what American power, where American power actually is affecting and where it isn't.
Well, I wonder about this. There's an argument to be made, again, in favor of diplomacy to some extent. I mean, if you look at, as you said, the behavior that John McCain was talking about came as the sanctions were applied, suggesting that the sanctions aren't doing much good. If you take a look back at Iraq when we were sort of goaded into war by the Bush administration, we were told that they were building a nuclear capacity. Interestingly enough, under the harshest sanctions that we could possibly apply, international sanctions, two-thirds of the country was overflown by British and American warplanes. And still, the U.S. argued that they were developing this thing without it. So you could argue, wow, they don't really work at all, do they? On the other hand, the argument might be, yeah, but just wait it out. You know those Americans will give in sooner or later.
Yeah, while we're waiting it out, though, we're destroying an entire society. When the 2004, the State Department produced a report looking at why it was so difficult to govern Iraq after the Iraq War. And there were many factors, obviously. The dismantling of the entire Iraqi state, obviously, is a critical factor. But they also pointed to the fact that after 10 years of some of the harshest sanctions that any country had been, Iraq had essentially become ungovernable. Because not only had institutions been destroyed, the very fabric of society had started to wither away under those circumstances. Iraq's economy had been shrunk to, I think, about $16 billion. And that meant that the very incentive structure of individuals in Iraq had changed. So, for instance, Iraq, which used to be one of the most highly educated countries in the Arab world, produced 50% of all books in the Arab world back earlier in the 20th century, now had a situation in which Iraqi families stopped sending their girls to school. Because there were no jobs for them anyways. There was no value of sending girls to school in an economy that didn't exist any longer. Now you tell me, how are you going to build a prosperous, more democratic society after sanctions have increased female illiteracy? So we have to realize that not only does these sanctions not particularly work well because confrontational policies tend to yield confrontational responses, even from much, much weaker parties. But in the long run also, it very much undermines the very fabric of society and the very elements that are needed in order to make sure that a society which reached that level of progress in which it has a stake in moderate policies, that he has a stake in a status quo. Let me give you one piece of statistics which makes me optimistic about how this deal can change Iranian behavior, the very same behavior that Senator McCain is objecting to, how this actually is more effective in addressing that concern. Iran's middle class right now is 60% of the population. In spite of the sanctions, one of the highest in the Middle East, next to Turkey. If Iran grows with a relatively moderate rate of 5% a year for the next 10 years, as a result of the sanctions relief, Iran's middle class will be 85% of the country. A country that has 85% middle class is far more likely to pursue moderate policies and seek stability than a country that has a much, much lower middle class. Middle class is an absolutely essential element for a democracy. And sanctions did the opposite. It was hitting the middle class harder than anything else. Sanctions relief, however, can bring us in that direction. And while there are no guarantees, the point is that the likelihood is definitely on the side of Iran moving in the right direction in its foreign policy.
How does ISIS fit into all of this? And does this deal have an impact on ISIS and its progress in the Middle East and our relationship with Iran?
I think ISIS was a stark reminder that at times, as problematic as many of Iran's policies were, we had also kind of stared ourselves blind to where the real threats in the region were coming from. I thought it was very interesting an interview that President Obama gave, when he was asked about how he views Sunni and Shia radicalism. He said, look, radicalism and extremism is very wrong everywhere. But then he pointed out that when it comes to the type of Shia extremism that we're dealing with, these are organizations that move in a very calculated way, that are pursuing national interests, etc. And then he stayed silent on the Sunni extremism, because that's what he was referring to, of course, then is ISIS, etc., who are not pursuing these type of things, are far more dangerous, are not respecting national boundaries or anything of that kind. And I think this has been a reminder that at the end of the day, if we want stability in the region, we will have major problems with many of the states. We have major problems with many of our allies. The Saudis have been the root of much of the financing for the terrorism that has been taking place, particularly the terrorism that have come all the way to the United States. Yet they're an ally of the United States. In the Middle East, we will have, at best, the best of enemies and the worst of friends. But it reminded us that we do need to work with many of these entities in order to be able to address ISIS. And it was fascinating to see the Iranians were on the first on the ground helping the Iraqi government, helping the Kurdish government beat back ISIS. And through the Iraqi government, the Iranians and the Americans coordinated the fight against ISIS in Iraq. In Syria, that has not happened in the same way. It might happen. The Russians and the Iranians have been pushing to address ISIS first, Assad second. I think the United States is not necessarily buying into that, but is definitely coming to the view that a much more serious effort against ISIS is needed.
Given the political realities inside Iran and inside the United States, how do you see the future for relations between these two countries?
I don't think we can say that any partnership or alliances is frankly in the cards right now. I think the Islamic Republic is not a state that a regime that the United States easily could ally with in a more formal way, because of the history, because of a lot of the lingering emotions. And unfortunately, on the Iranian side, the same thing. Many of the hardliners in Iran opposed the nuclear deal with the international community and the United States, not because of the details of the nuclear deal, but because of the very concept of striking a deal with the United States. because it opens the door for what they truly fear, which is that the United States and the West would once again be able to come into Iran, that trade and open contacts, etc., would make Iran vulnerable to Western influence, which is what they really are fearing when it comes to the United States. So they very much work to keep the enmity alive. And I think we saw this summer there were plenty of members of the Senate who are also very much terrified of the idea of losing Iran as an enemy.
What about the relationship with Israel and our close security ties with Israel? How much of an impact will that have?
I think Prime Minister Netanyahu did a tremendous amount of damage, long-term damage, to the U.S.-Israel relationship over the course of this past summer. I think what perhaps started off as a very rocky relationship between Obama and Netanyahu, which started off from their very first meeting in the White House in May 2009, developed into a very rocky relationship between the Democratic Party and the Netanyahu government. And as such, Netanyahu helped the Republicans turn Israel into a partisan issue. And for those who have worked very hard to maintain a strong Israel-America relationship, bipartisanship has been the most important principle. That Israel is not a partisan issue. It's something that both parties support strongly. And that has definitely been fractured. But I think beyond that, there are certain geopolitical realities that politics are not going to be sufficient to be able to bridge. I think the interests of the United States and Israel over the course of the last 5 to 7 years has strongly been diverging in the Middle East on the issue of Israel and Palestine, on the issue of Iran, as we saw, but also on the larger geopolitical issue of the order in the region. And this is going to continue regardless of who gets elected in the United States 2016. This is not limited to Obama.
Trita Parsi, founder and president of the National Iranian-American Alliance and an expert on U.S. relations, author of 2 books. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
He's going to be lecturing about the Iran nuclear deal at UNC Chapel Hill's FedEx Global Education Center tonight at 6, Duke's Lilly Library tomorrow at noon, and you can get those details at our website, stateofthings.org. North Carolina Public Radio is a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.